for the latest legal insights in sport, welcome to the Charles Russell Speechless Podcast, The Score.
Hello and welcome to the second episode of our sports podcast series, The Score, where we discuss some of the hot topics in the world of sport, and we hope you'll forgive us for doing so. We're going to talk about some of the legal issues out there right now. My name is Emily Bennett, and I'm an employment lawyer here at Charles Russell Speechless, and I'm joined by my colleague Becky Lawton, who's also in the employment team. Perhaps unsurprisingly, we're going to be discussing an issue in the world of sport today with an employment law angle. Today, we're going to be looking at the employment status of funded athletes, with a focus on Jess Varnish, the former Great Britain track cyclist who brought an employment tribunal claim against both British Cycling and UK Sport after she was dropped from the British Cycling squad. As Becky will explain later, in that claim, Ms. Varnish sought to establish that she was an employee or a worker of either or both British Cycling and UK Sport, and therefore had associated protections.
So, Emily, when you say funded athlete, what do you mean by that?
Well, it's got different interpretations, but for the purposes of this podcast, what I mean is an athlete who is largely or solely funded through a world-class performance programme with a national governing body. Okay. Currently, there are over 1,000 elite athletes, I think it's closer to 1,100, who are funded by UK Sport up to a maximum of £28,000 a year, tax-free.
So what employment status do funded athletes have?
Well, as I think you're going to talk about later, there are three categories of employment status. Employment status is really fact-specific, and an athlete's employment status will very much depend on their individual circumstances. So, for example, in professional team sports, such as football, the squad members are usually treated as employees of the team. That's because the club will exercise a lot of control over the players' daily activities, such as how, where, and when they train, and when they play. Control, as I think you're going to talk about later, is one of the main factors in determining the employment status of an individual. In individual sports, such as tennis, however, professional athletes are usually treated as being self-employed. That's because they will usually decide on their own training schedule and sponsorship or commercial activities, and they've got a lot more autonomy in making decisions around these topics. So they're regarded as being self-employed consultants, essentially. For funded athletes, such as Jess Varnish, the situation really isn't as clear-cut. Hence why the employment tribunal challenge by Ms. Varnish, which British Cycling and UK Sport tried to get struck out at quite an early stage, but they weren't successful, and that's because the tribunal believed that there were a lot of quite complex considerations to look into. So currently, funded athletes aren't treated as employees or workers of the national governing body. When it was defending the Jess Varnish claim, British Cycling and UK Sport drew an analogy between national lottery funding for athletes and a university grant, rather than an employer or employee relationship. But is that correct? As I mentioned earlier, in relation to professional footballers, one of the main factors in establishing that an individual is an employee or worker is control, so the degree of control that the individual is subject to. In the case of funded athletes, continued funding is usually dependent on them achieving certain targets, or it might require them to attend particular events, which has led some commentators in this field to believe that this exercise of control points more towards employment status. Another key factor to look at in relation to employment status is mutuality of obligation, by which I mean, is there an obligation on the employer, in inverted commas, to provide work and on the individual to perform that work? It's hard to see how this argument would swing in the balance of employment status where the athlete competes in individual events, because here the athlete is pursuing their own sporting goals and the governing body and UK Sport are supporting the pursuit of those goals. But what about where the athlete also participates in team events? Here, the athlete will, like the footballer example, be subject to a greater degree of control in terms of mandated training and participation requirements. The tax authority, HMRC, doesn't treat funded athletes' funding awards as employment income. However, just to complicate matters a bit further, an individual's tax status isn't necessarily determinative of their employment status, because the tests applied by HMRC and by the Employment Tribunal are slightly different, which is something that the government's consulting on simplifying in the future, but that's the position that we have at the moment. So as you can see, a funded athlete's employment status is very fact sensitive and subject to a number of different tests and criteria. So no one legal decision for one athlete or in a particular field is likely to determine the employment status of all funded athletes, because there will obviously be differentials in the main parts of the test.
So if they're not employees and they're not workers, what protection do funded athletes have?
Well, currently, if they're not treated as employees, which they're not, they have very little protection if they're removed from a funding programme. Because unlike an employee who will have unfair dismissal rights if they've been in employment for a certain amount of time, they don't have any kind of associated protection. If they're also not considered to be a worker, and I know that you're going to talk about the difference between employees and workers, but if they're held not to be a worker of the governing body, they also don't have worker protection against blowing the whistle if there are any practices that they're unhappy with, or against discrimination. Although potentially they could bring a discrimination claim against the governing body on the basis that the governing body is a service provider, but that protection is more limited than the protection under the Equality Act for a worker. So I've obviously mentioned Jess Varnish a few times.
Why don't we take a look at her case in a little bit more detail. Obviously, you probably had your head in the sand if you missed the press coverage that we had towards the end of last year, December, when the preliminary hearing of Jess Varnish's claim went to tribunal in Manchester. And that the purpose of that preliminary hearing was really to determine her employment status, to see if her claims could proceed. So she was claiming unfair dismissal, for which you need to be an employee. She was then also claiming sex discrimination, victimisation and whistleblowing detriment, and she either needed to be an employee or a worker for either of those claims to carry on. So it was obviously for her legal team a really big hearing. I think they were in tribunal for 5 days hearing evidence from various people as to how the day-to-day working relationship between both her and British Cycling and Varnish and in UK Sport operated in practice, as well as what was sort of in the paperwork of their agreements. But I think it goes without saying, really, that the case was hugely important for the sports sector, because if she was determined to be an employee or a worker, then she would have had enhanced rights that were unintended and would have been expensive to fund. So
would have had a lot of consequences.
Yeah, hugely. So I think ultimately it would have meant that there would have been much less funding to go around for athletes, which means that fewer athletes could pursue their goals. And it was interesting, actually, the athlete agreement that Varnish signed, and obviously the tribunal pored over in great detail, was actually signed, was actually a template that was used across 43 other sports that were funded by UK Sport. So you can bet the people that drafted that agreement were sweating the outcome of this case.
And presumably that agreement had provisions in it which said that she wasn't an employee.
Yeah, absolutely. So there was an express statement.
Not that necessarily means anything.
But yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there were express provisions within that agreement that stated her employment status, and also she was given the opportunity to take legal advice before she signed up to that agreement. But the reason that employment status is so important is because different statuses attract different protections. So self-employed people, they have the least amount of protection. And the trade-off for that really is that they have more beneficial tax treatment. But ultimately, if
and
they're...
More
freedom, yeah. So more autonomy about how they carry out their role in terms of, you know, how, when and where they perform their duties and things like that. But ultimately, they can bring discrimination claims, for example, if they are required to perform their work personally, but they don't get things like paid sick leave or holiday. They have to take the kind of financial risk on not getting paid when they don't work. Whereas next rung on the ladder would be workers who have more rights than those who are self-employed. They have the right to paid holiday, national minimum wage, limits on their working time, for example, and protection from discrimination and on whistleblowing, but they do have less rights than the sort of gold-plated employment status. So employees have all the same rights as workers, but they also have the additional protection of things like paid holiday and sick leave and unfair dismissal protection, which they accrue after 2 years of service with their employer. So that's why, for example, Jess Varnish was pursuing an unfair dismissal claim. She needed to satisfy the fact that satisfy the tribunal that she was an employee to be able to pursue that claim following the termination of her agreement with British Cycling. So as we were talking about employment status and the various different elements of that, the case law that's been applied here, the sort of legal tests that the tribunal were applying, they're not anything new. They're exactly what we've seen.
And they're not specific to the sport industry. They are...
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a generally accepted test that is applied to determine someone's status.
Yeah. So there's three key elements that need to be present for an employment relationship to be there. And the first would be mutuality of obligation. So that's really an obligation on the part of the employer to provide work, and for a corresponding obligation on the part of the employee to accept and perform that work in exchange for consideration, which is obviously in most cases cash. There'd also need to be an obligation to perform the work personally, and the employer must exercise a sufficiently high level of control over the individual. And it's interesting because Jess Varnish's case really fell at the first two elements there. So the judge was saying that she had no mutuality of obligation because she wasn't actually performing any work in return for a wage. So the structure of the arrangement was that British Cycling provided all the facilities and equipment and support that she needed to train to achieve her goals of winning medals on the international stage.
And then it was her choice as to how and where she did that.
So she didn't have a huge amount of control over where she trained, but the idea was that she kind of worked on this individual rider plan with one of the British Cycling coaches, but actually she could alternatively use her own coach. She didn't have to have the one that they provided. But in terms of the wage that she received, in inverted commas, to satisfy her argument that she was an employee, actually that was funded by UK Sport via an athlete performance award. So she had to apply for that, it was means tested, and actually she had no guarantee she was ever going to get that money. So it's really quite distinct from a wage that you'd get on a monthly basis,
which is guaranteed.
Yeah, absolutely. So as well as determining that she didn't actually get a wage, so she wasn't satisfying that part of the mutuality of obligation test, she also was determined not to be actually being provided with any work by either British Cycling or UK Sport. So actually what they said was under the agreement that she signed, her obligations were to develop and agree an individual rider plan in close consultation with a British Cycling coach. So on that basis, she wasn't actually providing, they weren't providing her with any work. She wasn't carrying out work. She was kind of training towards an end goal that was mutual in terms of for the benefit of British Cycling and for her own personal goals. Yeah, and then, so I found that the personal performance quite interesting, because normally as employment lawyers we kind of look for a right to substitute, and that would be indicative of somebody being self-employed if they're able to send somebody in their place. Obviously, when it comes to the highest level of cycling, you can't send somebody in their place. If I went in Jess Varnish's place, it would not quite be the same result. But what they were saying here is that you can't really overcome the fact that she has to perform her obligations under the agreement personally. She couldn't send somebody else. But actually what they said was, again, she's not doing any work. She was personally performing a commitment to train in accordance with her rider agreement, and that wasn't consistent with employment status. So I think it's quite interesting, and it's quite nuanced, and it all, I think a lot of it fell on how the agreement was athlete agreement was worded. But again, for the same reasons, she wasn't considered to be a worker under the agreement either for British Cycling.
And worker is like a halfway house between an employee and someone who's self-employed, isn't it? So
yeah,
they've got less protections than an employee, but more protections than somebody who's genuinely in their own business.
Yeah, it was kind of a statutory creature that was designed to kind of plug that gap between the gold-plated employment status and self-employed individuals who had a lot more control over their work. But in terms of UK sport, for example, that seemed to be a much easier decision when it came to Jess Varnish. So they basically said that she was simply funded by them. They were a public body that provided funding, a tax-free grant that then meant she was able to train and try and achieve her goals. So they didn't really have a huge amount of day-to-day contact. She was at one point, I think, trying to allege that they had delegated their duties to British Cycling, but that didn't seem to hold any traction with the tribunal judge. So I think they said the only real commitment that she had under the agreement with UK Sport in terms of receiving that funding was that she had to allow them to use her image and agree to up to 3 national lottery appearances a year. But actually in practice it turns out, because there's so many athletes, she never had to do any of those national lottery appearances. So, I mean, it's been appealed. In March, they confirmed that they were appealing the decision. So this isn't the end for the sort of Jess Varnish saga and employment status. We don't have any details for the basis of the appeal.
I think the appeal is just against British Cycling, isn't it?
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
In which case, UK Sport can drop out of the picture and watch everything unfold. But we have no idea what the point of law is that they're appealing and whether it'll be considered in the same way.
Mm.
But it'll be interesting to see, and no doubt the sports sector will be glued to the developments to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, I think although the outcome of this case will obviously be hugely important for elite athletes all over the country, it won't necessarily be determinative of their rights, because it's so fact-specific.
Completely.
And the agreement that you just talked about obviously went into so much detail about what the relationship actually was, and that will be the case for all the different sporting bodies.
Yeah, and we can't, I guess, ignore the fact that if the contract is a complete sham, so it might be in a different sport, actually they're not following the terms of the contract, the athlete agreement, in the same way that British Cycling have with their cyclists. So if the day-to-day operation of the working relationship and that training relationship isn't actually in accordance with the terms of the agreement, then a completely different outcome could occur, because the tribunal will basically say, well, the agreement's not worth the paper it's written on, you clearly
doesn't reflect what's actually happening.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. So it doesn't mean that, I don't know, BMX biking has a completely different outcome. So I don't think you can count your chickens too early on this one.
So obviously if Jess Varnish had been successful in her claim, well, her employment, the employment part of her claim, then funded athletes would benefit from employment rights, which would include, as you mentioned, paid sick pay, holiday, pension. Also, as employees, their earnings would be subject to tax and national insurance deductions. So they'd be worse off in that respect. But I think, you know, it's clear to see that an obvious consequence of those increased costs, not only daily costs, but also admin, HR costs from a recognition that, that these individuals are employees, would have a detrimental effect on athletes all over the country, because UK sport just wouldn't be able to fund as many potential athletes because it's only got a certain budget.
I mean, you'd be paying things like holiday pay, and I don't know, I think it could be completely different territory if that was the case. And you can understand why Jess Varnish has pursued this case. She'd put everything into her training, and you know, certain comments had been made which are completely inappropriate, like
there was a discrimination angle, wasn't there?
Yeah, so I think there was a comment of, why don't you just go off and have a baby, something along those lines, and I believe that's been denied, but you know, you'd want to feel like you had some kind of legal recourse once your career, your main career, is over, and that seems understandable. But it just seems like actually the terms on which she knowingly signed up to train with British Cycling have completely precluded any kind of recourse for her. But I think the analogy you said, you mentioned earlier about university relationships with students being akin to what we're looking at here, I think that's quite an interesting analogy, because you're obviously not an employee or a worker of a university when you're attending. You're just using the facilities that you have and making the most out of the opportunities that you're given whilst you're there.
It wasn't my analogy, just to be clear.
Yeah.
It was the one referred to in the defence of the cone.
Yeah, that's right. So both respondents put that forward. But I think it's quite a helpful analogy. Well, that's it for this episode of The Score. Thanks so much for listening. We hope you found it enjoyable. And if you have any questions, be sure to get in touch with us. You can follow us on LinkedIn and on Twitter too, @CRS_sport. But until next time, it's goodbye from us.